Yeah, so I put some curves here, and this is just free. I mean, this is not what we're going to talk about today, but I had some people in the office hour, so I thought about this. So if you think of recall and precision with respect to time, which of these curves can be a legitimate recall curve, and which of these curves can be a legitimate precision curve? Or more importantly, are there any curves that cannot ever be a recall curve, cannot ever be a precision curve? Which one? What? Say something. Three is what? It cannot be possible. Just it's like very simple dimensional analysis, but you may not have thought about this. Your recall can never reduce. Okay, because that's why, you know, once you said it, it's out there. You can't take it back. Okay, as you keep giving more and more results, your recall can never reduce. The only thing you can reduce very effectively is your precision by talking junk, right? So it's interesting to know that. I mean, because recall is monotonically increasing, or it's monotonically non-decreasing. It doesn't have to, I mean, between two parts, recall may remain the same, but it can never go back. It cannot come fall down. And you don't see this normally yourself, because what you're actually having is, this is basically recall as a function of time, and this is precision as a function of time, and you essentially got rid of T, and you wrote precision as a function of recall, which is a, you know, precision recall curve. Okay, so there you don't necessarily notice that the recall never comes down, but here obviously you will notice. Okay, okay, so why did this thing come on again? I don't know. Okay. Actually, it's fine. I don't really mind. Okay. So that's about that. Any question? Yes.
Number two is not possible in precision.
Number two is not possible in precision.
Precision.
Why?
Precision can never remain constant.
Precision. That's actually a good point. Precision can never remain constant. It is a good point. I didn't think about that. That's a very good point. Did people get that? Right, because whenever you say something, either you're saying something relevant or something irrelevant. So precision cannot stay constant. That's a very good point. I didn't think about it. I mean, again, there are many ramifications of what we already know that we don't necessarily compute. But part of getting a deeper understanding is computing the ramifications of what you already know. I mean, coming to this class, I didn't think that I would write these particular curves. Neither did I think about the fact that precision won't, ever remain constant. It either has to fall down or fall up, go up. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I understand, but even if you can, I mean, time, the only thing we really care about is the number of documents. It's still a very reasonable point. I think it's a good point. Yes. What? Precision can increase and it can reduce too. What?
Should it increase over the time?
What do you mean, should it increase?
Shouldn't it be like first result should be?
No, precision can increase as well as reduce over time, is my point. That, think about like an interview where you started talking sense in the beginning and then slowly started talking nonsense, so your precision went down. You started talking nonsense in the beginning because you're very nervous, and you slowly started talking sense, so your precision went up. But everything you said is out there, so your recall never reduced. Okay? Okay. So what I'm going to do is going back to what we were discussing day before yesterday, on association clusters, which is a way of doing correlation analysis to figure out, to remind you, what we were talking about is, if you think of terms as, the documents as vectors in the space of terms, or terms as vectors in the space of documents, then if you were to consider the term-term correlation matrix, then that should be a diagonal matrix, if in fact the terms were truly independent. Okay? And if that is not to be the case, then the non-diagonal entries can tell you something about how closely correlated is another term to this term. Okay. And then, so we were trying to figure that out. And there is this point which we'll come back to later. And so the idea was the simplest unnormalized correlation matrix might be, so suppose I have these three keywords and these are the documents, the unweighted correlation matrix would be, so this is a TD matrix, TD times TD dash, a TD transpose will get me a TT matrix, and that's this matrix. And as I said, the problem with this is some terms are much more in love with themselves than other terms are. And what you really care about is you assume that a term is 100% correlated with itself. Every term is 100% correlated with itself. And if you normalize it that way, then you can actually get a better feel for which terms are actually well correlated with this term. And to do that, what we figured out is basically think of these as the correlation values, the unnormalized correlation values for this is C11, C12, C13, and then similarly C21, C22, C23, etc. Okay, so to normalize them, what I take, let's say to normalize this number, I will just take C12, which is 4, and divide it by C11, C12 minus C12. No, sorry, C11, C22 minus C12. Okay, so the idea, one way of thinking about this is really this is sort of what you're computing here is a Jaccard similarity matrix. Okay, so you're computing intersection by union. And when you're computing the union, if you take the sizes, then you double count the intersection. So you subtract an intersection. That's one way of understanding. Okay? So essentially I compute, if the original matrix is CUV, the new matrix would be CUV by CUU plus CVV minus CUV. Okay? If I do that transformation, then I will get this matrix. Okay? And so in this case, I had then figured out that K1 is most correlated to K3. Now, of course, you don't quite know what K1 and K2 are supposed to be correlated here because you don't know what these terms are. So we go back to our example for which you do have an idea, right? So this was, remember, your database and statistics example. So I don't do any fancy improvements. I just take direct raw term frequencies in this case, and I just compute term-term correlation matrix, which is this, okay? And then I compute the normalized term-term correlation matrix, which is association clusters, which is this, okay? If you see now, obviously what you actually see is the first term, which is database, is most correlated with the second term, 0.77 correlated with the second term. It's correlated most with SQL. That sounds reasonable, okay? And similarly, the last term, linear, T6, is correlated most with the T5, likelihood. So linear is somehow correlated more with likelihood. And what about likelihood itself? Likelihood is correlated most with databases, apparently. It's correlated with regression. Okay, so it's a reasonable thing. So you just basically did matrix multiplication followed by some normalization to capture what you wanted to capture, which is the certain terms are actually, they belong together, right? So that's that. And so one other piece, since we came all the way here, one other little more improvement we can do is having computed this matrix now, notice that this is the T1's row, the K1's row, K2's row, K3's row. Right? That's what it was. So the K1 really, what this matrix is doing is, of course, it's doing the term-term correlations. But you can, one thing that we'll do is we'll start looking at everything as a vector, okay? So now I can think of the term as a vector in the space of other terms, including itself, right? By sort of abuse of, intuition, okay? Now if I do this, now this is my T1 vector, this is my T2 vector. Why shouldn't I compute the similarity between T1 and T2 by computing the vector similarity between those two vectors. You see what I'm saying? Because you did vector similarity, you have two vectors. I just showed you two vectors. Why don't I compute the similarity between two terms, a better estimate of the similarity between two terms by taking the vector similarity between the two vectors corresponding to those terms. Now, if you were to do it, what do you get? Obviously, you'll get something slightly different from this, right? What does it capture? What it captures is the following scenario. Suppose the first one only captures pairwise correlations. So if T1 is present always if K1 is always present in every file where K2 is present, K1 and K2 are well correlated. Now, if K3 is present in many of the files where K2 is present, then K2 and K3 are well correlated. But then to the extent K1 is correlated with K2, K2 is correlated with K3, K1 is really correlated also with K3. Right? So I have 200 documents, this is from an old times, but they have 200 documents with Bush and Iraq in them. Okay? And then similarly, I have 200 documents, additional documents with Iraq and Saddam in them. So in however small a way, Bush is related to Saddam. Because Bush is related to Iraq, Iraq is related to Saddam, so Bush is related to Saddam. It may well be that there is no single file in my corpus where Bush and Saddam are occurring together. Okay? And yet, they are related. And the term-term correlation matrices that I considered would not have computed this. Whereas when I do one more step where I take the entire T vector, T1 vector, and take the, the cosine matrix, cosine similarity matrix with the T2 vector. So now the new matrix that I'm computing is I will start, so first there was the unnormalized one, then I got the normalized one, and then the third step, if I want, I can then basically say a new matrix where the ijth entry would be the vector similarity between the Ti vector and the Tj vector. Right? Okay? I can do this. And if I were to do this, so this is called another name. It's called scalar clusters. So here I have normalized correlation matrix. And if I take this vector and this vector and take their, so for this term here, this should be T1 dot T2. So this dot this. Dot product of this. Okay? So that's what this would be. Now, if I were to do the same thing for my statistics example, so I already have association clusters. Now, I basically am going to take each of these vectors and take their dot products and put the ijth element. And then if I were to do this, what happens? So in this particular case, all I have found out is that database is most related to SQL and the second most related to index. That's what we found based on this. And then, that more or less makes up for your tuition dollars. That's like the best animation you'll ever see in this class, at any rate. Right? I no longer know how to do this. But anyway, so in this case, if I were to then take the Ti dot Tj, right, then I will get a new matrix, which is very similar to this, except notice that database has become even more friendly with SQL. Even more friendly with SQL. So in this example, the friendliest terms haven't changed, but in some other example, it might change. Because co-occurrence is sort of transitive. You know, you are occurring with this guy is occurring with this other guy, so in some sense, you are sort of related. That's what you're capturing in this, okay? So the names for these, this one is called the scalar clusters, this one is called the association clusters, but this is a cute idea. This is a very cute idea for computing correlations between terms. That doesn't require humongous math, because the next thing that I will be talking to you about would be the most technically sophisticated lecture in this whole class, which is latent semantic indexing. Okay, but this one, very easy to do. Okay, so now having come here, the one question of course is, what am I computing these clusters on. So I started here with the TD matrix, so term document matrix. Okay, so in some sense I'm analyzing the document corpus. Remember I said anytime I can do something with the document corpus, I can also do it with the query logs, if I have query logs. Okay, so here is a slide basically saying you can do this entire analysis over the document corpus, or you can do this entire analysis over the query logs, and which both of them will give you useful information. Okay, if you have query logs, probably you would like to then, you know, that basically will tell you that people typing this word also are typing this word. So maybe I should throw this in for you. That's how query completions are done. Okay, except as I said, query log based analysis does have this cold start problem. If nobody is using your search engine, then you don't have query logs. And because you have no query logs, you don't give good results, so nobody is going to use your search engine. So if you don't have query logs, then a second best idea is at least to, so another idea in this case is to do it on the document corpus. Now when you're doing in the document corpus, there is an interesting question. In some sense it's also true here, but it's even more true here, which is, are you going to do this this computation over the entire document corpus? That means the TD matrix now would be, T would be the size of the vocabulary, D would be the size of the document corpus. So a million by, you know, 8 billion. Okay? Are you going to do it at that level? That would be called global thesaurus construction. By the way, this whole thing is called thesaurus construction because in some sense you're computing functional synonyms for words. Roger's thesaurus basically tells you, given this word, what other words have similar sense. Okay, here you are computing a functional thesaurus, right? So you can compute a global thesaurus this way, and it'll be costly, but you do it once and you're done. Or you can compute a local or query-specific thesaurus. How do I do that? This is obvious because you have a document corpus. This one, you run the query first. Get the top 100 or so results that you have. And then analyze those 100 documents with for term-term correlation. So you only do the TD matrix over that. Okay? And then find what are the other words that seem to be close to the query words. And then tell user, would you like to add some of these words to your query? That would be allowing query elaboration, for example. Okay? Now the trade-off between this and this is sometimes with respect to a specific query, there may be stronger correlations with between two words, which kind of go away when you look at the entire document as a whole. Okay? So for example, with respect to computer science queries, the word operating is very friendly with system. With respect to the universe, operating is probably just as friendly with room, operating theater, military operation, something or other. So the connection between operating and systems is gone when you look at the entire document corpus. It's not any stronger than in many of the other connections. So the thesauri also will change, right, based on whether you do it locally versus globally. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't understand what you said.
I guess I don't understand from this to that.
Oh, from this to this. So for example, if I want to get this number is 1, 2, right? Element 1, 2. So I take the first vector and the second vector, take their dot product. Take their cosine theta similarity, which is dot product divided by their normalization factor.
So
yes.
Essentially, that is this matrix square.
What?
That one is this one square.
No, you also normalize. Yes, it's true. I mean, that's connected. But it's essentially, in your case, you take this vector and this vector, take the cosine theta similarity. That's what that number is. And you know the connection that he's making is, as you keep, you know, how many of you remember how to compute transitive closure in the 310? Transitive closure involves starting with the neighborhood matrix, keep multiplying it by itself. As you keep doing this, you get transitive closure matrix. So that's the connection he's making. One way of getting transitive closure is keep multiplying the matrix by itself. Okay, that's good connection, by the way. You know, that's what you should be doing. Connect everything to everything. That's the only way. Unless you have like a brain paralysis, everything will stay. Whereas if everything is a different piece, they'll slowly fall through the sieve, you know, of your brain. Okay?
I'm having a difficult idea.
No, all I'm saying is this is a matrix, right? This matrix has ijth term.
Yeah.
So ijth term of this matrix is the vector similarity between the ith row and the jth row in this matrix. Okay?
Ijth term is equal to jith term.
It will be, obviously. I mean, correlations are symmetric, unlike friendships. Our love, you know, unrequited love, for example. Okay. So that's basically your document corpus and, you know, query logs aspect, and then remember that you could do it in either of them. And in fact, one of the interesting things is this analysis could be used to get the effects that you have seen in multiple places. The one that I was trying to show you last time was when I type Sushovande in my Gmail, and I did this, in fact, just before, you know, coming to the class last time, it would say, consider including Yuheng and Raju and Rohit. Not because, I mean, the only reason it did this is because it basically realized that in the mails I send, I tend to send mails, whenever I put this guy's name, these guys tend to be, you know, co-occurring together. So he did a co-occurrence analysis. Okay? So now this is across from, you know, IR to, you know, email completion. So to now, suppose, you know, I was thinking all this while about, you know, correlations between terms and documents. So documents are bags of terms. And then I was computing the term correlation. And I can say email messages are bags of addresses. And so then I can compute the address correlation. Okay? I can also do the following thing. Amazon users are bags of purchases. Right? And so they can actually do correlations between purchases. And then say, you know, people who are buying this thing are also buying this thing. So would you like to buy it? And if you do that, that's collaborative filtering. You see what I'm saying? It's the same idea. You know, again, it comes under different names, but the technology is basically the same. So in the case of collaborative filtering, which we'll again talk about a little later, basically what we are doing is, you're thinking in terms of documents, you're thinking of users as bags of their purchases. Products are the words, okay, and users are the documents. Okay, using that, you compute product-product correlation matrix. Okay, that way you can tell people, you know, if you're buying these products, then people like you who buy these products also are buying these other products. Why don't you buy it? Okay, so the idea is the same, essentially. Okay. Collaborative filtering is highly connected, essentially the same idea. Okay, so that's about term-term correlations and basically correlation analysis, which is a very useful thing because you are able to get through this aspect of if the terms are not independent, can we then exploit their correlation? Notice that if the terms were independent, you would not have, I mean, to know that a language is English redundant. Any language which has a thesaurus is redundant. Do you understand what I'm saying? You know, in a non-redundant language, there should be exactly one way of saying everything. In every one thing that you want to say, there should only be one way of saying it. Okay? If there is a thesaurus, that means there are 10,000 ways of saying the same thing to confuse people. Okay, and so English obviously is redundant, and so you can talk about, you know, Roger can actually write his scissors. And our documents were obviously, you know, redundant in the sense they have correlations, terms have correlations, and so you can then compute term-term correlations and figure out functional scissors for your vocabulary. Okay, now when we saw this slide before and we didn't look at this part, which is that if in fact terms were independent, then they won't be correlated. If they are not independent, they would be correlated. And here's the interesting thing. Now, we started with lemons because we made this huge assumption that documents are vectors of terms and we can use, you know, dot product, similarity, etc., etc. All of that theory depends on the terms being independent. Okay? But then we found that the terms are not independent, and rather than just lose hope, we said, well, we'll make lemonade with it. We'll actually realize, figure out exactly which terms are correlated with other terms. They're not independent, but this will help us tell which are correlated with what terms. Right? That's what we did. Okay. So, but actually we didn't solve the original problem we had, which is our assumption was that the dimensions are independent, vectors in an independent dimensional space. Okay, so now I will ask this different question, which is, if in fact it's not a diagonal matrix, that means if I take TT matrix, it's not diagonal, that means the non-diagonal entries are not zero, that means terms are not independent, right? Then the question is, can I not produce, by change of axis, a new set of terms which are independent, such that both the documents and the terms that I am talking about are really vectors in this other space? I said this is the most technically sophisticated thing you have to do, and we will do this basically, which is, we are now talking about this possibility that both the terms and the documents are really entities in some other space. Where the dimensions of that space are the basis vectors are actually orthogonal as well as linearly independent. So it's an orthonormal basis. So why can't I find a new orthonormal basis to this space? If I were to do that, then I will actually figure out what are the things that are being talked about in the various documents. And you don't need to worry about correlations anymore. You're thinking of, you know, in some sense, you might say, well, I made the lemonade already, won't I lose it? Well, you made lemonade because you got lemons. You don't need the lemons. It turns out that, in fact, having independent dimensions would be much more helpful in terms of actually computing, you know, real similarity between documents. Okay? That is what we will actually explore starting today till probably, you know, part of or most of next week. This is basically this idea called dimensionality reduction, okay? And some of you probably know about it, some of you don't, so I'll lead you through it, like a bunch of examples, and then finally get through how to do it, you know, for linear dimensionality reduction, okay? Okay, so bear with me as I go through crazy examples which may have no connection to this course, but this one actually does. Suppose I start with documents described in terms of just keywords U and V. Suppose, you know, my document corpus is made up of documents, only the words U and V. My document corpus, basically, my vocabulary was just U and V. Suppose I have that, okay? So suppose I had some number of documents, D1 to DK, which have this, U and V as the original words. Okay, up to this it's fine. Now, suppose a bunch of new keywords were made up, where, you know, a keyword called W was made up, where W is nothing but 2U plus 3V. So, for example, if this document had UUV previously, okay, that means it has two U's and one V, okay, that's the document before. Okay, now after this, I'm introducing a new dimension, W. So for an outsider, W is now an extra dimension, so the documents now are three-dimensional. Except you and I, the malicious people, know that W is really nothing but 2U plus 3V. So I would just say this would be what? 2u plus 3v is 4 plus 3, 7w. So this document UUV has now become UUV and 7w's. So the documents have changed. Suppose I do this. Okay? Will you be able to, and I give you these documents. Notice that the original documents actually were they were living in a two-dimensional space. They only had U and V. Now I give you these documents. Up front it looks like they live in a three-dimensional world. Right? Now they don't really live in a three-dimensional world. It looks like they are, but in fact if you knew this, you can figure this out. But I didn't tell you. I did this, you know, without you knowing it, or at least you have a friend that you're trying to, you know, trip up. So we now give to your friend these documents. Could your friend figure out, that the document she is given are really two-dimensional, not three-dimensional? Think about this, okay? Don't have to answer. Just start thinking about this, okay? Next. Suppose after doing this, I think the friend somehow figured this out, let's say. But I want to make it even harder. I would say W equal to 2U plus 3V, you know, maybe they sort of figured out that there's some kind of a correlation in this W's and U's and V's, in particular this linear dependence. Somehow they figured this out. I want to trip them up even more, okay? And I will say, actually, W equal to 2U plus 3V plus epsilon, which is a Gaussian noise, some noise. So every once in a while I'll add an extra one or subtract an extra three or something, where which is a random variable, hopefully from a zero mean Gaussian. Now, can your friend figure out that the files that she was given are two-dimensional, not three-dimensional?
It's easier.
What?
It's easier now.
What?
It's easier now.
No, it's not necessarily. Think about this, okay? So because the noise can actually, your hypothesis that you have about what the connections are might be tripped up by the noise in this case. You will never be able to find a simple rule plus noise. Now, of course, once I allow you noise, everything can be noise, right? So how do you decide which one is noise and which is not noise? Okay, so can you tell that? It's not enough. I want to go further. Suppose further, at this point, so basically by this time what I would have had is 2u plus 1v plus maybe 7.37w, right, because I added like a 0.37 error, you know, noise, right? Okay, and remember that I'm talking mostly about W, but really I'm adding a whole bunch of them. I'm bunch of new keywords of the form 2u minus 3v or 4u plus v, etc., etc. So I made up a whole bunch of extra keywords. So in fact, this, you know, originally two-dimensional document might have many extra dimensions. So it looks huge, big dimensional beast, but really it's a two-dimensional beast. Knowing that obviously should be easy, because remember I told you that our intuitions about high dimensions are bad. And so why would you want to think of everything being in higher dimensions when it is actually in a lower dimension space? Okay. Now, and then so in this case, after this noise addition, then it is 7.37W plus 8.34Q plus blah, blah, blah. So the extra terms. No, all of them with linear dependencies plus noise thrown in. And then the third, final malicious thing I do now, I get rid of U's and V's from the document. So now I will actually be defining this document. This document now will be just defined as 7.37W plus 8.34Q plus 4.79J, etc. So the original dimensions that these guys were living in are gone. Those dimensions were probably orthogonal to each other. The new dimensions that you came up with may not even be orthogonal. They may not be a basis, first of all, and even if they're a basis, they may not be orthogonal. Okay, now can your friend figure out that looking at these documents, what you are really giving her are these documents. Notice how many things she has to do. First, she has to realize that the terms in the document are really not the final terms making up the space. They themselves are vectors in the original space. Because each of these are vectors in the original space. And that's the only thing left now. The reality is gone. Only made up terms remain. And she has to figure out the noise part. And she has to figure out the dependencies between these terms. So in some sense, what she needs to do is go from here to here. Can she do this? And why should she do it? There are two issues. Okay? Why should she do it? Of course, she should just change friends so that they won't be, you know, messing around with people like this, right? Now, why do we want to do this in our problem? Because the fact that keywords in the document are not actually independent, and that they have synonymy and polysemy. That means keywords might mean the same thing, and some keyword might have more than one meaning, okay? Can often manifest itself as if some malicious oracle like yourself started from untouched true document and did all these manipulations and gave you noisy data in the wrong dimension. Okay? And to really get to the truth, you have to get back to this. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it looks like a very weird thing to do. Why, you know, make my life so much harder? But to understand dimensionality deduction, this is what you need to understand. The dimensions that you are watching may not be the dimensions that are actually the relevant ones. Notice that dimensionality deduction is connected to some idea called feature selection idea, which is I am defining you in terms of a bunch of features, and I might want to know which of these features are important. Feature selection is actually easier than dimensionality deduction, because in this case, I can't say which of these terms are important. In fact, all of those terms are derived terms. The real terms, the truth, is here, you and we. So dimensionality deduction changes the vocabulary. It looks for the real vocabulary under which there is basically independent dimensions, orthonormal basis for the data. Okay? The point that, you know, you can be even more meaner to your friend, and the way you could do this is you will say W equal to 2U square plus 3 log V. And if you do that, you then have done nonlinear transformations on the original data. And then you're trying to figure out the original dimensions. That's much harder. So even for right now, in fact, we won't talk about nonlinear dimensional reduction. But a real dimensional reduction might also be nonlinear sometimes. Okay? So we will be talking about, assume that linear changes are being made, and can I reconstruct the data back? Yes, sir. It's happening all the time. Every document you pick, it's happening.
A real example.
Computer science. Why do I need computer and science? If I'm always saying computer and science together, why do I have to put computer as well as science? Okay? Convincing yourself that this happens is half the battle. Okay? And because you are in denial. You want to both, I mean, not just you, I mean, all of us are in denial. We want to both say that the terms are independent and complain that they are not independent. You can't have it both ways. If they are not independent, then you are in this kind of a problem. You may not have all the maliciousness here, but essentially, what I'm going to tell you is one technique that handles all of these together. And so, everything else that I did about correlation analysis is just a special case of dimensionality deduction. Okay? You may not do it because the world at large doesn't do smart techniques most of the time, you know, because they'll hire people like us who would then just basically find exponential approximations to polynomial time problems and, you know, execute them. And then, you know, it's so that, but in this course, we are actually trying to understand, you know, actually what's the right way to solve the problem. And then we may give up. Remember, did I already say this, that the difference between computer science and a hacker is computer scientist knows what's the right way to do it and then gives up on it. What the heck, I mean, I'll do, you know, the correlation analysis, which seems much cheaper to do, okay? But it's nice to understand this because it improves your conceptual understanding of all the issues that you would be repeatedly looking at here. Okay. By the way, try. I will answer questions, but as you are thinking about it, this will stay with us for three classes, probably 2.5 classes at least. As I said, it is probably the most sophisticated topic that you will be doing in this course, and it will need some time to sink in. Okay. So don't worry if you don't get it right away, but do think about, make sure that you understand things. Okay. Yes.
But why do you have to add the noise?
Because I can do noise. Because if you are writing your documents, let's say, you might add in extra words which have no connection to what the document is really about. Why did you do it? You did it. I didn't make you do it. You just did it. You know. So noise could be present. If it's not present, your problem would be somewhat easier. But it can be present. Yeah, and it's not that people are being malicious. People are just writing stuff in their documents, and the generative model, you think about this generative model. The generative data model is, there is an actual matrix, and then there was an error process that was done where errors were introduced. Okay, and then some omissions were done, like basically noise was introduced. Okay, and then what you get out, from what you get out, can you get back the original matrix? That's what we are looking at. Okay. Change of topics. Fish. You don't want fish? Yes, go ahead.
We are just looking for a way to represent the data independently, right?
What? I want to know what is the true dimensions of the data. I mean, you should be basically, this was the true dimensions of the data. I mean, remember, much of science is like this. We see currently some background noise in the universe, and using that we try to figure out that there was a big bang at some point of time. Okay, so I want to know what were the U and V, what were the original big bang dimensions given the data that I currently have. Except, you know, in the case of big bang, etc., these things can be hugely nonlinear transformations. What is left over could be nonlinear transformations. I'm only looking at linear. Wait for a second. Okay, let me continue. I know that this is a tricky topic. Let me continue some more, and then I'll take more questions. Okay? Okay, so fish. Right? I have fish. And I'm going to represent fish in terms of two features. Documents were represented in terms of two words, U and V. Here I'm representing this fish in terms of two features, the length of the fish and the width of the fish. I'm a vegetarian. I don't care. I couldn't care about things like taste of the fish. You know, who cares, right? So length of the fish and width of the fish, right? And so now I went ahead and I got a whole bunch of fish. I went and caught some bunch of fish in the Tempe Town Lake, and I plotted them in this XY axis, the length axis, the width axis. Each fish is a point in this space. So those are my fish in this space. The question is, are they two-dimensional fish? I mean, in the sense, is this data really two-dimensional? Or is it really one-dimensional with maybe some noise? Start thinking about this. And second question is, suppose too many features, length and weight for a fish, just too much. I want one feature for the fish. Tell me which one can I remove or which one can I keep? Why should I remove? So if I were to remove this, right, then what do I get? I'll get all the fish on this axis. Basically, if I remove the x-axis, then I get the y-axis projection. If I were to remove this, I'll get the x-axis projection. Is your best idea of these fishes is to project them on either x or y-axis? It really looks much better if the axis were like this. And if the axis were like this, that won't be size, and that won't be length, that won't be width. That's length plus width axis, which is called size. I just made up. You understand what I'm saying? Okay? So if I were to have this data, and if I'm trying to reduce the dimensionality, if For the heck of it, I don't want too many dimensions. You know, sometimes you don't know what is the true dimensionality of the data. All you can tell is, I just have too many dimensions. I'll reduce some. The question is, what am I going to reduce? Okay? Now, feature selection will say, remove my X or a Y, you know, one of them. But true dimensionality reduction first should check, are X and Y correlated? In this case, are X and Y correlated? How many of you think it's not correlated? Raise your hand. How many of them think that it's not correlated? More people said no, but I think only one guy is actually brave enough. And how many of you think they are correlated? Okay, tell me why they are correlated, that guy. Why do you think they are correlated? So what does correlation mean? The point is, if I were to give you the x-axis of a fish, do you know something about the y-axis of the fish? That's what correlation means. If there's no correlation whatsoever, how would this picture look? It'll look like a rectangle. Points all over the rectangle. The fact that it's not a rectangle, the entire rectangle is not filled, it's only a piece of the rectangle that's filled, means they're correlated. It's almost as if there is some sort of an ellipse living here and all the points are within that ellipse. And the ellipse metaphor is not bad. In fact, we'll get back to it in a minute. Okay? So the correlation essentially means, in this case, X and Y are correlated. So asking should I remove X or asking or Y is like asking should I remove your right eye or left eye. Okay? So the Sophie's choice can be converted by changing the dimensions. Essentially, in this case. Okay? So what I would do is, if I were to essentially realize that the best axis for this is this, and then take the orthogonal axis to that would be my two X and Y dimensions, they would then be maximally uncorrelated. And in that case, you can then pick, if you were to pick only one dimension, you can decide which one to pick. So for example, suppose I were to tell you, these are my new dimensions, this and this. Now I want you to keep only one dimension. Which would you lose? Would you keep this or this? Keep this, right? That was obvious now. What were you doing when you did that? Why was it so obvious? Somebody said spreading. Exactly. Variance. What you want to do is basically find the new axis such that the new axis capture, the first axis would capture the maximum amount of variance in the data. So which direction is the data most spread out? Then the second axis should be an axis that is perpendicular to the first axis and it captures the maximum remaining amount of variance. And the third and so on. If you do this, in fact, one of the beautiful things is because the dimensions are correlated, you don't need to worry about, if I want to pick k dimensions, I just pick the top k dimensions. Why is this a good thing? Why are you supposed to feel good that if I want to pick k dimensions, I just have to pick top k dimensions as against anything else? What else could you have been doing? Yes. Not just that. The issue is, remember, so in IR, right, if I rank each document in terms of the similarity to the query and just take the top K documents, would that be correct way to do IR? We said it's not. We said we have to consider diversity. We said we have to care about, once you compute the first document that's most similar, the second document should be the one that is most distant from the first document that is most similar to the query. You have to consider the residual increment. When you are considering orthogonal axis, you don't need to consider residual because you already made sure that the axes are orthogonal. This is all jumping ahead. I'm assuming that I have a rich uncle who will finally tell me, mathematically sophisticated uncle, who will finally tell me how to get orthogonal basis for this data, in which case I can then do dimensionality reduction very easily. You want to reduce the dimensionality to k dimensions, I'll just pick the top k dimensions. You see what I'm saying? Okay, so continuing with this example a little bit more. So if I am allowed to start messing around with the origins, in this case just, you know, shifting the origin itself is pretty good. Right? But that's not enough. Really what you want to do is you also want to rotate the axis. And furthermore, it's better if once you get this axis, the other axis is perpendicular to it, because then they would be truly uncorrelated, at the maximally uncorrelated. Okay? Now, so what should this, if I were to have this as my new axis, does it have a name in terms of the old data? No. Because in the old data, x-axis was length, y-axis was width. This is length plus width. You guys think length plus width is size. But when I said 2u plus 3v, you said that's not a word. I mean, u is computer, v is structure, and two computers plus three structures, I decided is a word and you didn't know what it means. In general, a linearly transformed word may not have any meaning that you can easily associate with if you are starting from the original feature. This fact that this can be seen as size, it's just because we are smart. We can decide, you know, that, oh, length plus width, let's call it size. If you can do that, then I say 2u plus 3v, let's just call it w. That's what I'm doing. The names don't matter. Names never mattered. Like, if names mattered, then your programs will die right away. They're just, you know, vectors in some random space. Right? Okay. So I would then say, if this is the original space, this I would call it some other space. It's a factor space. Okay? And I'll use the word factors because in latent semantic indexing, that's what we'll do. Okay, so we're going well, actually. As I said, if I only compute the dimension size this time, then I'll argue that I have captured the maximum amount of variance I could possibly capture by just picking one linear dimension. And you ask, how much? Well, it turns out that if you take this matrix, this data is, you know, can be seen as a matrix, and I can do eigenvector decomposition. Eigenvector decomposition can be thought of as putting a nice little ellipsoid over the data. In two dimensions, ellipsoid will be ellipse. In three dimensions, it will be an actual three-dimensional ellipsoid. And n dimensions, it will be n-dimensional ellipsoid that you can't visualize. Okay? So an eigen decomposition basically can be seen as putting an ellipsoid around the data and taking the major axis and the minor axis. Okay? If it's a two-dimensional ellipse, they will only have two axes. If it's three-dimensional ellipse, it will have three axes. If you have four-dimensional ellipse, there will be four axes. So these vectors that you're getting, eigenvectors, those are the major axis, next major axis, next major axis, and so on. Now, if I were to take this data and I do the eigen decomposition on this, then I will get this as the major vector, this as minor vector. How do I know which is major, which is minor? The major one has a bigger lambda. The lambda is really the size, 1.75 is the first eigenvalue, and 0.25 is the second eigenvalue. And 1.75, so the eigenvectors tell you the new dimensions. Eigenvalues tell you the importance of those dimensions. So now if I have to pick the top dimension, I pick the one corresponding to the highest lambda. If I pick two, I pick the first and the second. So just basically, you know, sort the dimensions in terms of their eigenvalues and pick them, you know, until I'm done with my dimension. Okay, so in this case, this is 1.75, this is 0.25. Now, what's interesting is if I were to just pick this thing, then I can actually give you an expression about the amount of variance in the data I lost. Amount of variance in the data I lost. One way I can lose, I mean, the whole point of data compression really is the dimensional reduction is a kind of a compression technique, right? I don't want to compress in such a way that all of you look alike to me. Do you understand what I'm saying? I want to remove some of the irrelevant features, such as some of you have longer hair, some of you have shorter hair, some of you are full sleeved, some of you are non-full sleeved. But if I just keep reducing the things to an extent that basically everybody is just one-dimensional, you know, pardon the pun, then I can't actually differentiate any variance among you. Currently, you are all unique. You know, you're all sitting in different places, you have different clothes, etc., etc. But the question is, what fraction of the variance in the data would I lose if I were to project away this dimension? And there's a nice little expression. It turns out that that's nothing but this eigenvalue divided by the sum of all the eigenvalues. So if I take top k eigenvalue, top k dimensions, then the variance that I'm able to capture with that would be the eigenvalues corresponding to those k dimensions divided by all the eigenvalues. That's the fraction that I'm capturing. So 1 minus that is the fraction of variance that I lost. I understand variance isn't something that you can feel excited about, but you do know that if the whole variance is gone, that's like saying entire document corpus is just really the same. You know, whatever your query, I'll give you some document because they're all the same. At that point, you have taken your dimensionality reduction too many steps too far. You see what I'm saying? Okay? So in this case, if I, you know, for this particular data, it turns out that if I just discard this axis, then I will only lose 12.5% of the variance. Okay? Now, do you see the connection between this and the document that we are talking about? You know, size and the length and width are like words of the document. Fishes are the documents. They are made up of features, length and width. And each fish is a point in the space of length and width. Each document was a point in the UV space. In fact, actually what you see, by the way, is the fishes that you saw are not in the UV space. They were in this space. Notice what makes you realize that there is noise here. It's not actually one dimensional. In fact, the dimensionality of the data is still two full dimensions. It's just that if you only keep the one dimension, you only lose 12.5% of the variance. And that's the noise in some sense. Okay? Had this been truly, truly one-dimensional data and no noise was present, then what would happen is all these fishes will nicely line up on this red line. And so you don't have to ask, what about the other dimension? There is no other dimension. You don't need to worry about losing variance there. So this is a scenario where really it is kind of a close to one-dimensional data with just a little extra variance left over in the second dimension.
So
yeah?
Can we have a circle with a screw, right?
Hmm?
If we have a circle instead of annulus, we
have interestingly, it turns out that eigenvalues, one of the, ellipsoid, circle is an ellipse, right? Right? And so what the problem with the circle is that it's basically its major axes are all the same value. So that means all of them are equal variance. It's not necessarily that basically means that's a true two-dimensional data. That really is a true two-dimensional data. Okay? But we will, one thing that we will talk about is, now that this is the first time in the class, formally we talked about eigenvalues and eigenvectors. If you consider the eigenvalue lambda 1, consider the eigenvalue lambda 2, subtract one from the other, that's called the eigen gap. Okay? And it turns out many, many things, the efficiency of many algorithms depend on the eigen gap, for example. Okay, so remember in the homework 0, you took a vector and you kept multiplying it with this matrix and then resizing the vector to unit vector. At some point of time, assuming that you have done this, if you didn't do this, you missed a beautiful experience. If you did do it, you would have found that irrespective of the vector you started with, in the end, you ended with the primary eigenvector of the matrix. The question is, you are guaranteed to end with the primary eigenvector of the matrix. The question is, how many iterations do you have to do before you get very close to the primary eigenvector? That depends exponentially on this gap. If the lambda 1 minus lambda 2 is high, with just a few iterations, you would already have gone to the primary eigenvector's direction. If they're very close, it'll take forever, but you will get there. Okay, so fishes are done. And the last thing I want to do today, and hope that at least some of you will show back up next class, is if you can do it for fish, why not for documents? Okay? In particular, we have documents as vectors in the space of terms that have been given, but we don't really believe these terms are the true terms. We want to find the true terms. Like, for example, we were given length and width as the terms, but the true term is size and whatever is left after size. Notice that, in fact, I don't even have a name for this guy. What the heck is this guy? I don't know how, what the name is. You know, I could say this is size. X plus Y is size. What is X minus Y? I don't know. I mean, you know, it's not obvious. The point is, these dimensions may not have to have any names that you can understand. It's just a linear combination of the old dimensions. Okay? So the question then is, the current terms are, it's like this is the religious person's dream come true. Everything we see is illusion, and we spend our lifetime trying to figure out the true reality. Okay? And what you see, the documents you see in front of them are just illusions, because they've been corrupted out of, you know, linearly corrupted. Okay? But engineering is, you don't need religion, you just need engineering, because entire world is corrupted. You know, the audio that you get is originally produced as a noisy audio, and then you filter the noise out so that you can hear the quote-unquote reality. Okay, so we are trying to figure out a filter that will get back the true dimensionality of this data. So transform the axis so that the new axis should have the following properties. Okay, the new axis of the data should have property one, they should be orthonormal. And that's why, you know, just one class before I sent this mail to the blog, knowing that nobody will read this. But it's, you know, you go back and read it to make sure that you understand the whole linear algebra of bases, spaces, orthonormality, because they're all important. Okay? So you want an orthonormal basis. Okay? And then, so that means, remember that the new fish axis are like maximally uncorrelated. And then once they are orthonormal, then they can be ordered in terms of some amount of variance each of them capture. And in some sense, that should be something related to the eigenvalue. I kind of gave away a part of the answer. And then in that case, finally, I can pick top k dimensions in this ordering and use these new k dimensions to do vector space similarity ranking. That's what I want to do. Why is this useful? Why the heck would I want to do it? Unless I'm really paranoid. You know, well, the reason is, just because you're not paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you, right? That's the old the bumper sticker. So just because you think documents, you know, are made by nice people, there's nothing bad with them, doesn't mean that they don't have noise. You know, nice people can generate noisy documents, okay? So why? Because it can reduce noise in the documents, it can eliminate dependent variables in the documents, and by doing that, it can capture synonymy and polysemy. If it turns out that computer and science always occur together, it really is a new word called CS, which is different from just the word science and just the word computer. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, so that's what you're trying to capture here. So this is the first time we are actually paying up on our assumption that all the dimensions are independent. And not only that, in doing that, we also figured out that, in fact, the data might actually be looking much larger dimensionality data than it really is. Because remember, this guy's case, its original dimensionality is UV, two dimensions. How many dimensions can I make the final data to be, look like as? Million dimensions, infinite number of dimensions, because I can make infinite number of combinations of U's and V's. Even just sticking to linear. And then even more infinite, bigger infinity, when you also throw in the nonlinear combinations, which we won't touch right now. He said, you know, you're screwed if it's circle, right? Well, you're really screwed, you know, pardon my language, he said this first. But he's really badly off if, in fact, the transformation is nonlinear. Because then the technique that I'm telling you would not work. The advantage of the techniques that I'm going to tell you is that they are polynomial in the size of the data, which should be happy for most of you, but it's really not happy if, in fact, the data size is humongous. Okay, so while this idea that I'm going to talk about, which is singular value decomposition, latent semantic indexing, is a beautiful, beautiful idea, The usual question, as soon as the class is over and as I'm trying to walk out, somebody will come and say, is Google doing it? You know, first of all, I have no idea what Google does. Okay? I have no idea. Okay? The question I'm interested in is not what Google does, but what it should be doing. That's what I'm supposed to teach you. Okay? The second point is that, in fact, it turns out that computing singular value dimension, singular value decomposition, which is a new type of decomposition that some of you, how many of you have already heard of singular value decomposition? You guys are way ahead. Good for you. Okay. Most linear algebra courses unfortunately end with eigenvalue decomposition. If you haven't heard about eigenvalue decomposition, I know that you just sleep well during linear algebra classes. But if you haven't heard about singular value decomposition, that only means your math teacher wasn't ambitious enough. That's why I sent you a link to Gilbert Strang's lecture on singular value decomposition. That's very nice, you know. And so you should look at it. So computing the singular value decomposition is only cubic in the size of the matrices. Remember, this whole thing is in terms of matrices. It's only cubic in the size of the matrices, which is good for you and me, but not necessarily good if the matrix size is in billions and trillions, which is one of the reasons why people don't necessarily do full-scale dimensional reduction. Okay? But the theory of it has ramifications to everything else, because you can see everything as just a special case of LSI, for example. Okay? Okay, so 10 minutes. Wow. So so I should take a picture of the class before SVD and after SVD to see who is left. Okay. So again, we'll go, as I said, I'm going to use two more classes next week, but you know, this is a good place to start today, and you know, it'll give you weekend to think about existential questions, such as what is SVD, why am I doing, what am I doing in this course, etc. So if SVD is the solution, in the previous case I said singular value decomposition is the solution. If SVD is the solution, what's the problem? Now you might say, well, why do you mean what's the problem? You know, I have a problem and this is SVD. It must be a solution. Mathematicians don't live for you and me. They barely live for their families, right? They do whatever is worth doing, you know, in their own sense, not because it will be useful for IR. So why the heck were people even doing singular value decomposition in linear algebra? Understanding that is actually quite useful, because it's connected to the notion of matrix approximation. Okay, so let me lead you through this, and it's a beautiful reason to appreciate all the linear algebra that you learned before. So remember the rank of the matrix. Again, many of these, if you have forgotten, I'm just repeating it, you know, it's all recorded in multiple different formats, listen to it or, you know, read something else. Rank of a matrix is defined as the size of the largest square matrix of this matrix that has non-zero determinant. Do you understand? Because if it's a square matrix, then basically you want to consider the sub-square matrix of that has non-zero determinant. Okay, the largest such sub-matrix. And if it's a non-square matrix, you can still get square sub-matrices of it. What is the size of the largest sub-square matrix of this matrix that has non-zero determinant? In general, how do you easily get rank to be zero for a matrix?
Every column equal.
Just make linearly dependent rows or columns. Do you see what I'm saying? So if I have a square matrix which is full rank, that means it's n by n matrix and it has full rank, then I can make it, so here's a good way you can get yourself a bad matrix, right? I mean, you don't need to actually do all the work. So suppose I were to give you a square matrix that's full rank. This is 10 by 10. I want to get a matrix that is certainly not full rank. What do I do? First, I add a column here, okay, which is a linear combination of the columns here. Then I add a row here, which is linear combination of the rows here. Bingo, I'm done now. Now I'm guaranteed to have determinant equal to zero. So then, when I give you this matrix, it's 11 by 11 matrix, but its true dimensionality is only 10 by 10. Its true dimensionality is 10 dimensions, because this other stuff that I added is essentially dependent. So notice, by the way, I did not mention it earlier, But if your rows are documents and columns are terms, then adding a new term is like adding a new column. I'm also adding new documents in some sense. What is that supposed to be? I can take one document in my corpus, add it to another document in my corpus, and make it a new document and throw it into the corpus. That's what I'm doing. That doesn't change the dimensionality of the corpus, because the new documents are just linear combinations of the old documents. That sort of like doubling the document is not supposed to change something, remember? That sort of the generalization of that idea. Okay, so rank of a matrix is defined as this, and in some sense the rank of the matrix is its dimensionality. Okay, my question then is, suppose I were to give you, you know, a matrix, you know, which is basically 100 terms by 1,000 documents, either 1,000 documents per 100 terms, DT matrix. Okay, now suppose I have to find its rank. Okay, first of all, just sanity check. Can the rank of this matrix be 103?
No.
That much you should know, because it's going to be at most 100, because the biggest square matrix you can make is of size 100. Okay, so suppose the document dimensionality is actually, the rank of this is actually 98. So that means the underlying data is only really 98 dimensional data, not 100 dimensional data, which you thought it maximally could be. Okay, now I don't really want 98 dimensions. Between you and me, I really want exactly 7 dimensions. How can I get a version of this matrix which will only have rank 7? It's a beautiful idea. Okay, so remember that I need to get, of course I can get a 7 by 7 matrix which has 7 dimensions. That's useless, because then this has no connection to this matrix. I want to reduce the dimensionality while keeping the matrix be as close to the old matrix as possible. Okay, so what I really want to do is, if this was M, I want to come up with another M dash, and its size should still be 1,000 documents by 100 terms. So they're equal sized matrices. And if these two matrices are obviously not the same, they have the same dimensions, so I can talk about the distance between them. The distance between, you know, vectors can be computed in terms of, like, you know, vector similarity, for example. What about distance between matrices? There are many ways of computing them. One would be uij minus vij square sum. So consider the difference between the corresponding elements between the two matrices, square it, sum all the differences. If the matrices are the same, it will be zero. If the matrices are far enough from each other, it will be larger and larger away, more and more away from zero. So now I'm getting somewhere. I have this matrix which is 1,000 by 100 terms. I want another matrix which is also 1,000 by 100 terms, except I want its rank to be 7. And since I'm in the business of being wishful, I also want that matrix, that you're giving me a matrix, and I say, no, wait, here's this other matrix, which is also 1,000 by 100, which is also rank 7, but it's closer to my matrix. So you lose. So what I really want you to do is give me a matrix M dash, which is of the same size as my old matrix, okay, which has the rank 7, and among all matrices of these dimensions and rank 7, this is the closest matrix. Now if you are a programmer and never were forced to take any classes in math, what would you do? Write a loop for finding all the matrices of a certain size and then give it to your, you know, manager and say, here, this is a nice loop, it will be done, you know, before the universe ends, and then, you know, and, you know, I would have gotten my paycheck. This is a beautiful optimization problem. You have infinite number of matrices of rank 7. Among those, I want the matrix that is the closest to this. And this is where, you know, remember the whole point of calculus is to find optimization, right? And this basically, if you were to use calculus of variations, it turns out that the optimum is connected, the optimum solution for this problem is connected to singular value decomposition. Okay, and singular value decomposition is defined, it's sort of like eigenvalue decomposition. We'll get back into the details next class, but you can read this slide, it won't stop you. And basically it's also defined for the, it's defined also for the non-square matrices, it's defined for everything. And it's the way it is you know, if I give a matrix M, I would, so if I, the singular value decomposition of a matrix DT would be three matrices, DD, I'm sorry, DF times FD and FF times TF prime. Okay, so that means DF times FF will be still a DF, DF times TF prime would be DT matrix, that. At least dimensional wise it's working out. Okay, so I will give you these three matrices. It turns out DF and TF would be orthonormal matrices. That means their columns are orthogonal to each other. That means they are actually orthonormal bases. Okay? So this and this are orthonormal, and this is a diagonal matrix. This is 0, this is 0. And it turns out the numbers here are basically lambda 1 square, lambda 2 square, etc., lambda k square. I'm sorry, no, it should be, what it should be is, it should be is S1, S2, etc., Sk, where S1, Si is positive square root of the eigenvalues, of the ith eigenvalue of D, D, R, T, T matrix. So if I give you DT matrix, I multiply DT by TD, I'll get DD matrix. If I multiply DT dash by TD matrix, I'll get TT matrix. Right? Both of them are going to be square symmetric matrices. So if you were to do eigen decomposition on them, you will get real valued eigenvalues. In some sense, those are the eigenvalues for this matrix except for the square of the matrix, because you multiply the matrix by itself, DT by itself. So you take the positive square. That's what your eigen decomposition is, and these play the same role as the eigenvalues. So if you were to ask for k dimensional reduction, I just make this particular last k guys, last n minus k guys, 0. And do the multiplication. I'll still get matrix of exactly the same size as the original matrix. And I just tell you, this is the best matrix of the rank k that you can ever get in terms of its distance to the matrix that you started. Okay, I will, for those of you who are interested enough, I will send you a write-up which shows that the solution for the optimization problem we talked about is actually SVD, but that requires background in calculus of variations. So suffice it to say that won't be on midterm. But you need to know what is the problem you just solved. Even if your uncle helped you solve it, okay, in the mathematics department, very poorly paid uncle, to mean, you know, to say multiple times. Mathematicians don't get any pay. You know, you guys, you know, who write, you know, infinitely long programs, infinitely executing programs, get much better pay than people who actually come up with this sort of stuff. But you should know, what did they actually solve? What did we ask them to solve? That's what we are basically doing. And next class, we'll come back and essentially do this SVD, and that's latent semantic indexing.